Hello, my lovelies. Welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job 2019 edition. Yes, we are in the new year. I want to wish each and every one of you a happy, a prosperous, and joyful new year. I do hope you survive the holidays relatively intact and that you are easing your way into new experiences, new growth, new opportunities in 2019. I'm so happy to have you here with us today. So we are at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S podcast.com. We're also on all the streaming platforms, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Podcast, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and more. If you are listening to us on one of those streaming platforms, we always love it if you could give us some feedback, give us some stars, give us some love, because the more we move up in the rankings, the more people can find out about our podcast and get the information they need to have a successful career in music. We talk one-on-one with these very talented, innovative, incredible movers and shakers of all aspects of the music biz, asking them exactly how they got their careers, how they got started, walk us through their career journeys, what decisions did they make, what obstacles did they face. You're going to get all that really, really good knowledge, insight, and wisdom here. So please spread the word. We would love, love, love it. So my last guest was Ben McLean. He is a prominent music attorney. He has written a book all about the music business that you can find on Amazon, and he just has some really great insight and advice about signing contracts, navigating the music biz, especially if you are working with a producer or you are going to sign with a label. So if you didn't get a chance, go on back and listen to that episode. And my next guest for this week, and I should say for 2019 to kick things off right, is Jeannick Bonnetemps. He is a very talented and innovative film composer, music composer. He has written for features, documentaries, virtual reality experiences, video games, so much more. His music has been featured in the blockbuster hit Creed 2, and he is going to be walking us through his very unique career trajectory. But before we do that, I want to feature one of Jeannick's incredible tracks from the Greenwood Avenue virtual reality experience. This is called The Burning of Greenwood. Here we go. Thank you so much for joining me on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? It's so fun to have you.
Well, it's definitely a pleasure to be here with you today, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Tell me about your first memory of music. Tell me about the household you grew up in.
Sure thing. My mother and father both immigrated from the Caribbean. My mother's Jamaican, my father's Haitian. But my mother always wanted to learn how to play the piano. My grandmother played the organ, and she grew up with listening to her play the organ. And it was a dream for her children to be able to play the organ and the piano. So when we finally moved to our house in Long Island, when I was about 4 years old, my mom went out and got an organ and got a piano, and that's when the lessons commenced. So my early memories are really sitting next to my organ teacher and getting punished, actually, because I didn't get the fingering right or I made a mistake. And whenever that happened, I would get a swift clap on the backside, as we Jamaicans would say. But if that didn't destroy my love for music, I continued to study organ and then eventually graduated to piano, picked up a little bit of guitar, played some drums, and then music was just always a part of my life. Also singing in choirs at church, choirs at school. So throughout my education, I was always involved in music, played in a jazz band, a jazz/rock band in high school, wrote original songs, accompanied singers. So it was always a part, but it was never really going to be anything serious for me. I had ideas of being a lawyer or something in politics, and music was just going to be a hobby.
Interesting. So when you were taking the lessons and you were learning, was it all like classical, or it was a mixture of classical and jazz, or what was the repertoire?
So it would be classical is where I started, was was the repertoire. It was all classical music and, you know, classical renditions for kids. Then when I got into middle school, high school, I really was more interested in jazz. So I started taking lessons with a jazz piano teacher outside of school, as well as playing in the jazz band. And then also doing a mixture of popular music as well, just because I was accompanying singers, so, you know, a series of Broadway show tunes. But the music that I wrote was either sort of pop or jazz, where I really sort of focused. And that really became more of a middle school, high school event for me.
You said you were writing your own music. Did you have any inhibitions about that, just having such a strict king with your instrument?
No, I had no inhibitions about writing music. I always enjoyed it. And it was something that, you know, obviously I did privately at first, and then all of a sudden I started playing it out for other people, and I started writing for the band, and I started writing original songs. And it never was anything that I was shy about, or shy about even playing in front of people, you know, in middle school and high school. So that was all okay for me, but I never really studied it as a craft, and everybody took it that seriously. It was fun. And there was never any ambition to do this for a living. I remember seeing a lot of my really talented teachers. They were all living at home with their mothers. And I was like, that's not the life that I want. Really talented people, I mean, amazing pianists, amazing players, great teachers, but they were home with their mom. And I was like, you know, I think I want to go out and make money, so I'm not going to do this music thing.
So walk us through that. Where were your college aspirations? What were your next steps?
So I ended up going to Yale University for my undergrad, which was, and I tell everybody, the best 4 years of my life. Don't tell my wife, but it really was. I really enjoyed my time there. And I started out by studying, I think it was English or political science, something like that, in these aspirations of being a lawyer slash politician. But my passion was still music. And I got this notion in my head saying, you know what, undergrad doesn't really matter. You should just study what you're passionate about, and you'll go to grad school to go be a lawyer. So I said, you know what, I switched then sophomore year to be a music major. And, you know, it was a very, you know, general music education. You had some music history, you obviously had some theory, you had some ear training, some composition. So it was really more of a survey as opposed to focusing on something like, say, just composition or focusing on songwriting. It was much more of a broad education in music, which I really enjoyed and I did really well in, and I enjoyed it, you know, a ton. And during that time, I also founded a singing group, because Yale is really known for its singing groups. And I decided to do a singing group and write all the music and produce it. But we were going to be an accompanied one, not an a cappella one. So I would play piano or I would write tracks. And, you know, my group, basically, we would perform them. And then I also was enamored with technology, so I started a recording studio. I worked with another Yale student, and we talked one of the residential colleges into giving us a space, and we turned it into a recording studio, really, you know, quasi-professional. I was actually very proud of my, you know, 19-year-old self putting this thing together. And we would rent it out to students as well as local people in New Haven community, and it became my job for 3 years, basically running the studio, training people, running sessions, getting, obviously, charging for the sessions. I had a salary out of it, investing part of it back into new equipment for the studio. So it was a great way to create a business out of it that I was passionate about as an undergrad, and it really fed my ambitions for music as a hobby. When I took my LSAT, I realized that law was probably not going to be the thing for me. So I ended up focusing more on music business. And I got an internship at Sony Music, and I would take the Metro North down from New Haven to Sony Music about twice a week to go intern at Epic Black in the marketing department. And, you know, my dream now shifted into being a music executive, which was great because...
Let me just stop you right... Let me stop you there for a second, because I want my listeners... I think it's very funny in a good way that you're like, oh, music is a hobby. me and I'm gonna go be a music major at Yale. Like Yale actually has, and this is for my listeners who might not know this, like Yale School of Music is actually one of the top music schools in the country. So the fact that like you're like, I'm just gonna have fun at one of like a very prestigious music school, I just think it's so great. And also the fact that you not only, you know, were taking pretty rigorous music courses, but that you also decided to start this recording studio, which again, I presume you really didn't have any sort of background knowledge, you know, starting or running or working in a recording studio, correct?
That is absolutely correct. I was one of these people that could always learn things from reading, and I would just read books and pick up the information and then be able to execute it. So I did a lot of studying as far as, you know, reading books around how to manage and run a recording studio and how you would configure the equipment. And, you know, honestly, it was also just a lot of trial and error because, especially being a student-run organization, not like I had, you know, top-notch bands or musicians coming in. We had a lot of school bands, and what we produced was pretty good, but very far from world class now that I look back at it. But we just had a lot of fun. I think for me, honestly, it was just more about doing something that I love and not having any professional aspirations, because that took all the pressure off of it. I was just enjoying myself, which also meant that I might not have pushed myself as hard as maybe I would have if I had a professional aspiration. So, you know, looking back at it now, if I had known that, I would have done things a little bit differently if I had known that eventually this was going to be my career. But at the time, mm-hmm. I would just have a good time.
But I think you're right, though, in terms of that it takes the pressure off. And I think that that's a lot of creatives need that to just, especially if you had some stripped music, to be able to just be like, fuck it, I'm just gonna do what I want and have fun with this talent that I have and look at what came out of it.
Well, it was a bit more of a journey before I decided this is really what I wanted to do. So going back to a little mm-hmm. bit, back to the internship, I interned at Sony Music, looking at the music business side of things. I got a position at Epic Records supporting a couple of music executives there, which was great. But, you know, 6 months later, for whatever reason, I wasn't the right fit. So I ended up being fired from Epic Records. Mm. And I was, you know, out on, not on the proverbial street, but, you know, by that point I had an apartment in Brooklyn with some friends, so I needed another job. At that time, I answered an ad in the paper for a computer programming job, no experience necessary. And I had dabbled a little bit in computers, you know, built my first little HTML website, that kind of stuff. So I go for the interview, and the guy hires me, to my surprise. And that then launched a 15-year career doing software development. And I basically, as I said before, I taught myself programming. First it was Visual Basic, then Java, and I eventually started running teams. Because one of the things that I could do really well was translate what the business wanted to do into a plan and systems that the developers then could execute. So I ended up being the guy in between that could speak both, and then I ended up just running software teams. I built a bunch of websites that are still out there today, e-commerce websites, bluefly.com, freshdirect.com for all my websites, and eventually it led me to a startup in Silicon Valley. Moved out to California, worked in Silicon Valley for several years doing software development there, and when a startup that I was an early member of was finally bought by HP, once the dust settled, I looked around and said, well, is this something that I want to do again? Do I want to go back and go to another startup and start all over again, like, you know, a lot of people do? And that really wasn't exciting for me. Of course, I could go do it, but I wasn't really passionate about it. And what ended up coming back now was music. That I was really passionate still about music. I was playing in the choir. I was playing for my choir. I was singing in the choir at church. I was still, you know, writing songs here and there. And I said, you know what? I want to figure out how I can actually have a career in music. I knew I didn't want to go on tour. I didn't want to perform in front of people or be part of a band or anything like that. What I wanted to do was produce music. So I said, well, if I'm going to produce music, how am I going to be able to feed my family? Because by that time, I had acquired a wife and two kids, and they weren't interested in being, mm-hmm. how are you going to feed them? And this whole idea of music for media came about. I was, you know, a gamer, and I enjoyed playing video games, and it dawned on me one day, oh, there's all this music in video games. Wait a minute, someone gets paid to do music in video games. Oh, wait, there's music in movies. Someone's getting paid to do that. This was a thing that I just didn't know existed. I mean, obviously I knew it was there, but I didn't really connect the dots and say that someone had this as a career and could, you know, make these wonderful pieces of music and live in this world and still be able to feed their family. So that's where my new passion came from. Okay, I'm going to focus on doing music for media. But of course, coming out of software, I had to figure out, well, how do you make this transition? Luckily enough, I met a guy named Clint Bajakian, and he was the head of game music for Sony at the time, one of the heads. And he took me under his wing, and he helped me formulate a plan that allowed me to make this transition. It included getting private lessons, getting certified in several programs, taking composition lessons, going online to Berklee School of Music and doing an online degree there, and then eventually going to the University of Southern California and completing their prestigious film music program, which at the time I had no idea wow. or any belief that I was going to get into the program. But, you know, with this guy's help and really sort of this targeted course of study, I was able to, you know, make my way into the school. The other thing that I realized from my business background was that you can never just be a name on a piece of paper. People have to know who you are. They have to have an interaction with you. So I went down to the University of Southern California when I was thinking about applying. I met the director at the time, a guy named Brian King, and I told him what I wanted to do. And he said, you know what? You have no idea what you're in for, kid. Well, I wasn't really a kid. I was a man at that point. But you have no idea what you are in for. I'm going to give you an assignment that we just gave our students. And, you know, you take that back, you do it, and then send it back to me. I found out later that he believed that I was never going to do the assignment. I was just going to give up. But I went back up north, did the assignment. I turned it in to him. And he said, you know what? It's actually decent. It's not great, but it's decent. Let's keep talking. I also was able to talk with a professor at the program, this guy named Jack Smalley, who was teaching composition there, and I coerced him to give me private lessons. So for about a year, I would fly down from Silicon Valley down to L.A. and take private lessons with this guy, Jack Smalley, who was a very prolific orchestrator and TV composer for decades. Mm-hmm. And he really helped, you know, helped me carry my application. So between those two things of really, you know, networking with the director and then also having a targeted plan, I was able to get into USC, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Wow. Well, let's kind of parse that a little bit. Did you find that with your software code experience that contributed positively to this new music endeavor, and especially in terms of like music software, that kind of thing?
Yes, it actually did it in two very important ways. One, as I said before, my job in software was to be the guy that would talk to the business about what they wanted and then translating that into a way that the coders can understand and providing an executable plan to get it all done. That skill set that I honed over, you know, 15 years of working in software on projects of various sizes has been so important for me as a film composer. Because my job is to talk to the directors, the producers. They don't speak music. We speak drama. Understand what they're trying to do, and then turn that into an actionable plan for me to be able to write the music. But also, because film composition or composition for media is a team sport, you have a team. You have folks that support you, whether it's assistants or orchestrators or the musicians or conductors or the engineer. You have a team of people. And being able to lead that team of people on a singular mission which is to get that score done. These are all things that I learned as part of software, because, you know, being a genius compositionally is only part of the job. You still have to deliver a product under a certain amount of money, within budget, and within a time frame. And those are all things that I learned from the software perspective. The second thing that I learned from my software career was actually working with computers. So much of what we do today to do music for media is based on computers and being able to run these sometimes multi-computer systems to be able to simulate realistically live players. Being able to simulate, you know, a jazz ensemble, or it could be a rock group, or even a full-fledged orchestra. You have a combination of the software pieces and hardware that really has to be all integrated together to build a system that then allows you to execute the music quickly and also have it sound great. So my technology background, both from using the technology in the recording studio as an undergrad, but also the technology of Silicon Valley and how to integrate programs and pull these pieces together to build a system, that came in extremely handy, obviously, for my own systems and how, you know, I was going to do the job that was given to me. But also, there's another important point here. When I got out of USC, there was no feature film or video game waiting for me. I had made a lot of great connections with filmmakers at USC, many of which I still work with today, but they're starting out too, and they don't have studio projects. I had a family, and the traditional route is usually you go, you know, get out of school, you become an assistant for someone, and that just didn't work out for me. A friend of mine, though, told me when I was struggling to figure out how I'm going to make ends meet, he said, listen, you have this great background in technology. You should use that in a consulting capacity for other people. And that was a eureka moment. I founded a company called Composer Tech, and I became the tech support person and systems integrator for composers in LA and eventually around the world. I founded that about 5 years ago, and today I've got clients, about 150, maybe 200 clients all over the world, that was able to support my family while I was building a career in on the music for media side, which was wonderful. It was related to music for media. I got a chance to meet really the top composers in the industry. They all became my clients. Alexander Desplat, Alan Silvestri, Michael Giacchino, Danny Elfman, the late Johan Johansson, Dustin O'Halloran, all these, and, you know, countless more have all become my clients, and I was able to learn from them and see their processes and how they worked firsthand and be able to inform my own process. So that was immensely valuable, not only from keeping the lights on, but also learning really from the masters firsthand how they approach their craft.
That's phenomenal. That's such a great, inspiring, out-of-the-box innovation to launch. I just wanted to ask, how are you still able to make sure that your artistic creative endeavors were, that's no small feat, launching a consulting business like that.
You're absolutely right. And that's where I would still continue to work with my filmmaker friends coming out of USC. And that's how I kind of knew my career was going to grow. I wasn't going to be working, you know, because there are a couple of ways in which it can happen. You could work for a more established composer as an assistant, and then maybe if you stay with them for, you know, 3, 5, 7 years, that a project could then launch your own project from that platform. Or the other way is you work with filmmakers, you know, at the grassroots ground level, and as their career grows, your career grows. So I was the latter, and I continue to work with many of my USC students' friends that were now no longer students, but they were making small projects, whether it's a web series or a short film, or they got a job doing a commercial. I was the person that worked with them. And the great thing was, since I actually had another job that was keeping the lights on, I was able to take whatever little budget that they had for the project and pretty much entirely invest that back into the project by either hiring musicians or, you know, hiring an engineer to mix it or buying a particular software package to give me the sound that I wanted. So I was able to take the pressure off of feeding myself from those jobs and invest that money back into the project, which, you know, allowed the project to shine just a little bit more. And little by little, as my director friends got bigger projects, they brought me along with them. So much so, there's a man named Stephen Caple Jr., who I worked with since his first project at USC, and he recently was the director for Creed 2, and was able to get me on as a composer, not the main composer, Ludvig Göransson, who did a phenomenal job in Creed 1, was the main composer for Creed 2, but on Stephen's request, Ludvig invited me to be a composer on the project with him. And that, again, was just the fact that over the years, everything that Stephen did, I did with him. And we were able to build that relationship together over, you know, several years. And I have that same relationship with several directors because, again, I had something else that was feeding my family, so I was able to continue to work on their projects for little to no money. And as they grew, I grew.
I love that. And I want you to just expand a little bit about the importance of relationships, because I think what I keep hearing over and over in the course of my interviews is, you know, it really truly is kind of a small town, you know, in terms of like film composers, or, you know, you're doing kind of a pretty small, very tight-knit community. And so I think it's so brilliant that you decided to make sure that even the business that was going to keep the lights on was going to be in and interacting and serving this particular community. So I'm wondering if you can expand on that.
That's a great point, as a matter of fact, because it's something that I think is really something that should be driven home for folks who are interested in this, in that when you want to do a music career or you decide this is what you want to do, you won't be able to feed yourself on your music just because it takes so much time to develop not only your sound, but also the relationships that are going to feed your career. Everything in this town is based off of referral. There's no place you can go to say, hey, film composer is needed, I'll apply for this job. No, everything comes through referral. Directors are going to ask their friends, hey, I heard this thing, or do you have a composer, or this or that? And through those grapevines, they eventually find you. But that means that you need to have relationships with people that you've either worked with for a while so they can trust you, so they can trustfully make that recommendation. So that's one side of it. But the other side of it is everyone who wants to do this thing needs to find out, well, if I want to do A, what is connected to A that I can do to make money? I don't knock it. If you have to go and be a barista at Starbucks to keep the lights on, and then you come home at night to do your, you know, music work, I understand that, and I respect that. But I ask people to challenge themselves, what skills do you have that are valuable, that are music-related, that you can do that instead? Because that's just going to inform who you are as a musician and help get you into the community of people that will then support your career later on. Maybe it's a copyist, and those are the people who create the sheet music that the player is going to play, or it could be an orchestrator. If you're a great musician, you could be a player. There are all these other ways in which you can use skills that you've honed over the years to make money that are directly connected to the thing that you want to do, because then you're in that community, and you never know how things will find you through that community and through those relationships that you're building.
That's a phenomenal, because I think too, time is so precious. Time is, it's not just about money. Time itself is a currency. So how are you spending your time, and can you maximize the time that you have to earn money, as you said, to navigate these relationships? I think that's brilliant. I'm wondering if you can also talk, since you really do know a lot about this, but talk about kind of the marriage of music and tech, because I really do feel, you know, we're in it now, and that's basically where the industry is continuing to go towards.
Right. Now, technology, I think, with all things media, because things have just become cheaper to do. I mean, if you even think about the original days of, you know, producing a film, you actually had to just shoot it on actually a film, and then you had to get that developed, and then you had to do cutting with. It was a very expensive and drawn out and lengthy process that required a lot of people. Now, folks are able to shoot amazing things on their iPhone, or they can code games on their laptop. So technology has just allowed us to be able to create things more inexpensively, and it's made it more accessible to many more people. And music is the same thing. Before, you know, to do a film score, you might needed to have recorded an orchestra of 80 to 100 members, right? Which is a very expensive prospect. Now, you know, with the advent of computers, we can do, it's not the same level, obviously, but, you know, realistic, what we call mock-ups or realistic sounding replicas of what that would be like. So that this way, if the film can't afford a real orchestra, you can still, using technology, create an orchestral score, even though you can't afford to hire 80 people to do it. And maybe the approach is I'm going to use what we call samples or sample libraries to record or to do most of the parts, and then I'll hire one or two players to come in and play on top of that, to add that, you know, evocative, natural human emotion that you really can't get out of the computer, but you've been able to get closer to it by hiring one or two people to come play on top of it. So like everything else, the technology has allowed you now to produce things much more quickly and much more inexpensively, so that it opens the doors now to more people to be able to do this. In the beginning of film scoring days, everything was pencil and paper. So you had to work with, really, it's really cheap, obviously, but to get that realized into a score that people can actually hear, that process was very expensive. So from that perspective, mm-hmm. I mean, technology just allowed us to have more people be accessible. Now, the other thing that's also been great for me, honestly, is that when I was, you know, studying at Yale, which is, you know, decades ago, we didn't really have all this technology for realizing music. And we would write these, you know, pieces for our classes, and they would never be performed. The professor would look at them and give us notes back, because obviously, you know, they had these amazing ability to just look at the notes on the page and tell you what was wrong, or tell you what it would sound like, or where the problems would be. But you would never really hear it realized. And that's what kind of diminished the love of music for me, because music needs to be heard. It's an oral medium. And you need to have it created or realized through these musicians. And that's what brings so much of the magic to what we're creating, to hear what it actually sounds like. Now we can do that with computers. We can simulate all of these sounds, whether it's synthetic or it's meant to be organic. We can simulate all of them and get immediate feedback as far as what something sounds like or what it would sound like. So you really sort of get that feedback loop very quickly. And technology provides that for you. For example, I'm working on a project right now called Greenwood, and the score is going to, it's an orchestral score, but it's going to be mostly what we call in the box, mostly created from my computers. And I plan on hiring one or two musicians to come and perform on top of that, just to give it that, push it over the edge and give it that live human connection. But most of the score is going to be coming from my machines. And that is a skill that is really important, actually, well, more than important, it's integral. It is one of the foundations of being able to do music for media today. Obviously, you have to have the compositional chops, but you also have the technology, because at the end of the day, you are competing with other people who have technology. And something that is wonderfully composed but doesn't sound great versus something that's okay composed but it's really well produced and sounds amazing, producers, directors, lay people who don't understand music are always going to gravitate toward the thing that might be, is just okay from a compositional standpoint, but it's produced really well and it sounds great and it really revs the emotion, as opposed to the thing that is really well crafted from a compositional standpoint, but it doesn't sound great. It's using subpar, what we would call samples or subpar sounds, and it's not produced well. So from that perspective, we really have to have the compositional chops and the production chops to be able to compete in today's market.
And do you find that there, because of all these sort of new platforms and, you know, what you were speaking about with me earlier, like VR and AR projects, and not to mention, obviously, all the streaming platforms creating original content, do you find that this field, you know, for film composers is just truly exploding and expanding? What's your take on that?
Well, there's more content being made today than ever before. As you said, you know, we have all these platforms now. We have all these new ways of enjoying content, whether it's VR, AR, video games, streaming platforms, whatever it is. We are creating so much content now. A large part of that has to do with technology. Again, the technology makes things cheaper to produce this content. It makes it cheaper to distribute this content, right? So we now have technology and infrastructure to get things to people very inexpensively or relatively inexpensively. What that also has done, though, has obviously for us composers, that there's more content for us to work with and there's more demand for what we do. But it's also lowered the budgets for those things as well. Because, you know, now that Netflix is doing so many shows, well, they need to parse out what money they have across all the shows that they're doing. So the budgets for the shows are smaller than traditionally what a network TV budget would be. So they're smaller, which also means that the money that trickles down to the composer is smaller. So the things that you would potentially be able to do with a larger budget project where you can hire people and an orchestra and then an engineer to mix your stuff, you don't have the budget to do that anymore. So it becomes, again, you have to put on that technology hat and you have to wear more hats because you still got to produce the music. You still got to create it for the project, but you just have less resources now to do that with. So you have to wear the composer hat. You got to wear the music engineer hat. You have to wear the synth programmer hat. And now you just have to pull in more of these skills that in the past were distributed across multiple people. Now you have to be the singular expert or practitioner of all of these skills. And that's what this technology and this proliferation of content has done, in that it's not like you're getting the same amount of money that you used to get for a particular TV show. They're making more of them, so more people now can participate, but the budgets and the amount of money that they're giving out per project has diminished.
Do you think that's a temporary thing?
No, I don't think so. Well, I think there's a pushback nowadays, and I'm excited to see this, about things like streaming platforms. Because as more people migrate from traditional broadcast to streaming platforms, well, at least the money you'll make now in royalties will start going up. Because more people are participating in that streaming platform. But the initial fee that you would get, I don't think is really going to go up, per se. I think it goes up when your brand goes up. So as you become known in whatever field it is, and you start to have a premium brand for yourself and your product, then of course you can command more money for that because your brand is better. And I think that's how you will continue to, you know, increase the amount of money you make from a particular project. Not that the projects per se are going to just start paying more. No, I think they're going to continue to have that downward pressure of paying less. But where hopefully we'll start making it up is as the streaming platforms get more people on them, there'll be more money to distribute back to the composers in forms of royalties.
Do you find that film composers need to kind of be, you were talking about brands, like be more self-promoters? You know, obviously back in the day, it was like the studios would dictate who would work on what. It was very traditional. And now, obviously, it's a much more sort of open playing field. So what's your take on that? Do you really need to kind of be your own best brand promoter, stand out with your brand, that type of thing?
Well, it's a combination of two things. Because this is where I find myself spending a lot of time thinking and figuring out this for my own career. which is, well, I'm going to approach it a couple of different ways. First off, I had the opportunity to have a great conversation with a composer named John Powell. And John Powell has done, you know, everything from the How to Train Your Dragon series to Happy Feet to the Bourne series. I mean, a prolific, amazing composer, extremely talented, really one of the top people in our industry. And he said to me, it is much more important for you to be interesting, for your music to be interesting than anything else, because that's going to allow you to stand out. And people might not like your interesting. That's fine. But someone will. So be interesting, be bold, be yourself, right? And eventually somebody will connect with you and resonate with you, and then you will have the beginnings of a career. So I think that's one part of brand, is being different, being yourself, being interesting, you know, really honing in on your voice and not try to sound like anybody else. Not even Chisa, don't even try and sound what you think they want for the gig. Sound who you are, be who you are. And if that resonates for the gig, then it does. If it doesn't, it doesn't, move on. I'm like, wow, okay, that's something to think about. Another way to approach the branding is, especially in music for media, the music is attached to media. We're not standalone artists per se. We live or die by people seeing the product that we're supporting. So if the film or the video game or the TV show, if that does well, well, then people will then by association, you will do well. Because you can say, hey, what have you worked on? I worked on this particular show. Or this movie. Oh, I saw that movie. I really enjoyed that movie. Then all of a sudden, wow, okay, this person worked on something that I'm aware of. And that's the tough thing, because you can write genius music for a project, an indie feature that nobody sees. Then, yes, you wrote the music, and hopefully you can use that as a demo or use that as a calling card for something else. But to the general population, to the people who normally hire you, they're not going to know who you are because they didn't know about that movie. Whereas, you know, again, you could write an okay score for a film that does extremely well and that is extremely popular. And then all of a sudden, people now know who you are by that association. And now they want to work with you because that film did well. Another mentor of mine once said that he knew a producer that would only hire composers if their last film made more than $40 million. Didn't matter what the film was. Didn't matter what the music was for the film. Your film had to make $40 million or more before I would actually talk to you. So we live or die by the film, and then we create basically a brand, you know, and a sound around those films or around those games, those pieces of media that we work on.
That's great. All right, well, I don't want to take up any more of your time, but how can, speaking of brands, how can people find you? Do you have like a website or something that people can follow?
Absolutely. So I'm on all the, you know, social media platforms. You can find me on Facebook and Jean-Yves Bonton Composer. I'm on Instagram, my first name, @Jean-Yves. And my website is bontonmusic.com. So www.bontonmusic.com. And I'm also represented by Kraft Engel, Sarah Kovacs over at the Kraft Engel Management Company.
Okay, phenomenal. Thank you so much, Jean-Yves. And I'm very excited to have you kick off 2019. So thank you again.
Well, thank you for having me. I hope I didn't talk too much or bore your listeners with all of my feelings. And I'm just hoping that, you know, something that I said will be helpful to somebody.
I have no doubt that Jean-Yves' words of wisdom are going to resonate, inspire, and empower so many of you. So special, special thanks to Jean-Yves for kicking off again our 2019 podcast year. We're so excited. And again, just to follow up, you can find him on social media at Jean-Yves, J-O-N-G-N-I-C, or on his website, Bonton Music, BONTEMPSMUSIC.com. So my loves, thus ends another episode of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? Again, I am your host, L. Ariel, and you can find me at L-A-R-I-E-L Music. That's on social media. Or my website is lariel-music.com. That's lariel-music.com. Follow us on social media. We are at Music Jobs Podcast, MusicJobsPodcast. We are going to be rolling out some exciting things for all of you in 2019. So please follow us on the Twitter, the Facebook, and the Instagram, because we want to get you in the loop, and that's the best way to reach us. Okay, my loves. So again, just, you know, don't kill yourself the first few weeks of 2019. We got to survive the year, but just remember, we're going to keep on hustling, pursue that dream, and don't you give up.